My name is Laurens Jacht, and welcome to Cybersecurity Talks, the interview podcast for cybersecurity professionals and for those who aspire to become one. Join us on our journey and learn about the latest trends, real-life war stories, and everything you need to know about this fascinating industry. Welcome back to Cybersecurity Talks. I'm very happy and excited to announce today's guest, an expert in the field of threat hunting, Lalit Bakuni. Lalit is the global head of active cyber defense at Volvo Group. He grew up in India, but moved to the Netherlands in 2008 to join the SOC of ING Bank. After that, he worked for different financial institutions, holding different positions, such as SOC engineering lead, incident responder, and threat hunting lead. Before joining Volvo in 2023, he was the global head of the Cyber Intelligence Center of ABN AMRO Bank, where he built and designed the Global Cyber Threat Intelligence Center from scratch. The last 4 years, Lalit has also been a guest lecturer at the TIAS University. So we're very, very excited to have him on the show. Welcome, Lalit.
Thank you so much, Laurens. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Lalit, you moved to the Netherlands in 2008 to join ING Bank. Was this a big step for you? And how did you make this happen?
Well, it was a kind of a big step, you know. And when I was in India, whether should I move first of all to Netherlands? Yes and no, because it was first of all a non-English country, and I'm not a Dutch influence, like you know. So for me, it was a really hard decision. But ultimately, I thought like, okay, let's take this shot and see that. Okay, what kind of a career holds for me over there? And since I'm like a traveler as well, so why not? Like so. So that's how I took my chance over there, and I came over here, you know, just for 3 months in the beginning, you know. But now it's been like 15 years, so it's been a long time.
And how was it for your family that their son was moving to the other side of the world?
Yeah, exactly. For them, it was also a kind of a hard decision, because initially they asked me like, okay, whether I want to go or move or not, because. Because in India, I was not at home, basically. So I used to work for a company called NIT Technologies, which is near to Delhi. And my hometown is in Uttarakhand state, which is a part of hilly region, basically. And still, it is like 10-hour journey from the Delhi side of it. So for them, like it still, I was outright. And when I see the journey from Netherlands to New Delhi by flight, it is still the 8 hours.
And you said you joined initially, the plan was for 3 months.
Yes.
How usually when you land a job, it's for a year, you get a contract for 1 year. But with ING, was this different or was it
an experiment? So I came over here by this company, the third party company, actually, in that kind of sense, you know, like, okay, so we have like, what we call as like on-site jobs, you know, so like, okay, yeah. Then I came over here, it's like, okay, yeah, it's a 3 month rolling project. We will see what happens after that. Yeah, so I worked for them, I think, till 2012. And then finally, I see that, okay, I think this is the country where I want to live. And then after that, I switched.
Yeah. And you worked, say, the first 4 or 5 years you worked in ING Bank, in the SOC.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you hold different positions, but at the end, you're really sort of an engineering lead.
Yeah.
But I was curious, how did you see sort of the attacks and the sophistication of the attacks change during those years? Because I think that period, a lot of things happened, a lot of successful attacks started happening.
Yeah, the way if you see these days, I think right now, if you see ransomwares and data breaches are so much bigger than usual, right? While if I go back into the time in 2008, 2010, it was not that kind of a case, or maybe they are not public. You know, so I think that could be the sense. So, and at that time, security engineering or security monitoring or security operations center concept was also not been matured. So people used to go more on the compliance side of it rather than go on the real detection side of it. That came later, somewhere after 2015 or 2016, as in maturity. So at that time, there were not much attacks or something like that. But as you know, that I'm a part-time researcher as well. So when I have a free time or something like that, I try to gather as much as information about these sort of an attacks or something like that. And also from the intelligence perspective, like how we can gain insight on this to get some more knowledge about these attacks and to prevent those attacks before they actually targeted the victim organization.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a part of the information sharing or something like that. So I see that it has been, this sector or like this domain has been evolved so much in past 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. But I was triggered because you said maybe there were attacks, but they were not brought into the public.
Yep.
Nowadays, there are sometimes even laws that it has to become
public. Exactly, yeah.
But you worked a lot in financial services also in the beginning days of the cyber attacks.
Yeah.
What's your idea? Were a lot of attacks not brought out, but they did happen? Or did the amount of successful attacks just increase lately?
It's about the insights and the visibility, you know. And back in the days, the security operations center concept was more on the compliance side of it. So people used to have loggings or something like that for the detection purposes, but not for the advanced attacks or something like that. So that's why those attacks were not being detected earlier enough, you know. And maybe sometime, and even now, if you see that when companies find out their attacks or something like that, their dwell time, like when they go back into their organization, like, okay, when was that attack happened? It's basically years ago. And why this is happening? Because back in the days, they didn't create those sort of measures on side of it. They have it, right? They have like security logging, everything is in place. But when it's come to like real optimized detection rules or something like that, they never did that one. And that's why now I see that, okay, a lot of organizations are moving into this direction where they do a lot of precautionary measures like doing the threat, like threat modeling, threat hunting, and they are like spending their resources on these kind of things. Back in the days, it was not the case. Threat hunting was barely known as a topic. Threat intelligence, yeah, it was there, but yeah, people know about this topic, not much. Only the big companies or something like that, even, yeah. So, but now the trend is changing and people see the importance. Business sees the value of this. And if business sees the values, then the security get funding and then everything is done.
Yeah, that's crucial, the funding part.
Exactly. It's very crucial, but it's very important as well, you know, because the asset which you are securing, if it is worth of billions, then I think that you can spend at least millions on that rather than just taking a damage of billion.
Yeah. I think that you worked in financial services. It's quite obvious what the damage could be financially, but also reputation, trust. So I think you worked in the right sector where there was always a budget available. But it's very interesting. I want to jump into that a bit more later.
Yeah.
But after ING, you joined SWIFT, which is one of the biggest payment providers in the world.
Yep.
Why did you decide to jump from ING to SWIFT?
Well, it was a very lucrative opportunity at that time because at the time SWIFT was also maturing their security services, not only on the corporate level, but on their services level or something like that. And when I see the financial vertical, and if you see the transaction-wise, SWIFT is actually the backbone of all these transactions, right? Messages-wise and all. So for me, being as a banking enthusiastic, it was natural, like, okay, yeah, to secure that kind of a thing because itself, it's an experience for me.
Yeah.
So, which I want to live for that one. And that's why I signed up for SWIFT. And then I think I've worked for them for 5 years and there was not a single day when I regretted my decision. It was like a wonderful journey.
Yeah, I see the smile on your face.
Yeah, exactly.
You had a good time there.
Yeah, yeah. I really had a fantastic time. It was, first of all, a global organization. And then I think in 2000, I joined in 2013, but 2015, we started developing SOC, basically security operation centers across 3 zones, Hong Kong, over here in Netherlands, and then in US as well. So itself, it was an experience like to build up these teams together with smart colleagues, you know, and then working together on that kind of a norm. So, yeah. So, yeah.
And what were the main challenges that you faced within SWIFT? What was the company most concerned about?
Well, company most concerned about the integrity of the messages, because that is important. Because a message transfer which you made it, let's say for 1 million, the other party should receive 1 million only, right? Not the 10 million or something like that. And at the time, you cannot afford that a message is being manipulated, means that his integrity is being ruined. Then, yeah, you lost the trust, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a big thing for Swift as well.
But for the bad guys,
yeah,
to attack Swift and try to really go deep into the backbone of the financial system, that's sort of really aiming high. Because if you can manipulate that, then you're really in a luxurious position. So where there are still a lot of attempts, because it's almost like a Mission Impossible, I would feel.
Well, if you see the threat actors, if you see, they come from the intent where they really want to do something like that, or either they are like a nation state or something like that, where they have been sponsored, right? And if you see the financial industry, and especially when we talk about Swift, and in that sense, yeah, it's a lucrative target basically. And in the past, in 2015, 2016, when started with the Bank of Bangladesh, you see that, okay, what happened, right? But it was not Swift which has been directly targeted, right? It's the banks where they have been targeted, and their infrastructure has been used basically to manipulate these transactions. If you see, there is a quite a detailed reporting on Bank of Bangladesh case, you know, by BAE Systems and by others, like how they actually manipulated the transaction and how they actually did that one. It was 990 million in the beginning, but at last they were able to stole only $90 million. What happened with the rest of the 900? It's a kind of a really cool story, like, okay, what happened? And also how criminals do also mistakes in that one. Just a spelling mistake can cause millions to them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating word. But the one time I always say it, especially when it comes to the defender's life cycle of it, and also on the dark side of it. So dark side doesn't have any GDPR kind of laws or nothing like that. No company policies, something like that. They have a motivation and they have an intent and they have resources. So they have to only success once, right? But when we go into the blue side of it, which is defender side of it, we have rules, we have policies, we have to work under those policies on this. And so, and also we have to always succeed, always in terms of defeating them. So there is a huge amount of pressure on the blue side of it, which I sometimes see is an unfair advantage to the red teamers or to the dark side of it. Because they have all the luxury while on the defenders. Yeah. But there's also a broad responsibility and a bigger responsibility to safeguard those systems.
It sounds you're fighting on the wrong side.
Yeah, I mean, like, but if you see, especially from the society side of it, being on a blue side of it, it means that you are also contributing to the worst society.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. So when I was doing my Intel researches or something like that, and if I see any sort of an attempts or attacks which are happening towards hospitals or something like that, directly inform them. Why to wait for it? You can save lives, basically.
Literally, yeah. You can save lives, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
But recently in the Netherlands, we saw this case where an ethical hacker worked for a pen test company, and he was also a volunteer. And he was discovered as being one of the main sources of a lot of evil and a lot of not so ethical hacking. So that's also very difficult to see who's ethical and who's not ethical. I would believe that if you have bad intentions, you would be on top of the game on the wrong side of the field with all your experience.
Of course. And especially the way the current threat landscape is, where the bad side of it, which we call as the e-crime syndicates, they have a lot to offer.
Yep.
I mean, like in the past years, basically these syndicates are offering like millions for the insiders. So yep. It means that if someone has like the bad intention and somebody wants to be overnight millionaire, they just reach out to this, right?
So how does one stay sane then? They say, at least from the American movies that I've watched, that everybody has a price. But I can imagine if you work for these big financial institutions or with Volvo Group, that it could happen that somebody reaches out in a certain way and puts a number on the table and it is untraceable, then some people might do something very unethical. Is this a strategy that has been seen in the field?
Well, I didn't see the case yet, but what I heard, especially from the reportings or something like that, yes, there were some cases happened like this, where the insiders were involved in these kind of stuff. And then, of course, because the offers were lucrative and also the traceability angle, because the insider, they have the access to it. They can even also remove their tracks, like what they did, or auditing wise or something like that. So, yeah, it's possible, but on the right side of it, if you see from the defender side of it, that's why the organization are putting these sort of in controls, like from the policies level for it, ethical side of it, legal side of it, and also on the behavior and analytics, what their employees are doing. It's not to some sort of a surveillance towards employees or something like that. It's just to find someone like, okay, yeah, who has a bad intention.
Yeah.
You know, but sometimes what I see, people think that, okay, they have been surveillanced or something like that. But that's not the intention. It's only the intention is that we all are doing our jobs in the right way, basically. If there was any sort of anomaly or something like that, then it has to trigger, right? So that's why these days when people actually hire new talent or something like that, they always also look into the ethical side of it. But whether the person has ethics or not, you know, sometime or not only sometime, but always. So I'm also a hiring manager, right? So whenever I hire people, I always look for one quality first of all. And that quality is their attitude, right? Because skill wise is, of course, is important, but skill can be taught. But attitude is something like that, but you cannot teach it. Your ethics, your manners, those are the very important stuff, right? So yeah. And if your ethics or you are an ethical person, then of course you will not do anything which ruin your career, or not only you're ruining your career, but ruin your image.
Yeah. And can you go a bit deeper in how do you test for attitude, but also how a person is ethical?
Giving them some sort of a scenarios that on those scenarios, how they will act or react basically. So let's say that, in one of the cases, like, okay, if they have been approached by a threat actor or something like that, then how would they react? Either they're going to play a game with them while involving the blue side of it, or either they're just going to accept it or something like that, or either they just ignore it. Because there are ways as well where you can play a kind of a dummy, but then still you can actually plot them into a set where you can work with law enforcement agencies, or your organization can work with them, and then you can actually become a valuable information for them. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there are scenarios, but also the way people think, actually, the way people think about the ethics in terms of in cybersecurity, like what is their reaction about the procedures in journal or processes. Do they follow these process and procedures? You know, personally, I'm a process oriented person. You know, I believe in a process, result will come anyway.
Yeah. Now, but it's very interesting working in financial institutions that you really are careful with who do you bring on board and who do you give all this access. In the last season, we spoke with Manuel Garant. He's the identity access management lead from booking.com.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really interesting conversation where he also explained that insider risk is really a threat. So what happens if people are made redundant or they have an issue with their manager, what's going to happen then? And with companies as the size of Booking or perhaps also Volvo or ING Bank, you have so many people. So how are you able to watch all those people? And when everybody's happy, nothing bad will happen. But of course, in such an organization, you have also a lot of disappointed people. And
of course, yeah.
Then people make different decisions, perhaps. So I think this insider risk is really a new threat, or not a new threat, but a way bigger threat than a decade ago.
Exactly. It is there since the beginning, you know. It's just that we have started realizing the fact that, yes, it exists, you know, and because there are cases which has been reported on these issues and all, and then organizations see the risk which is coming out of it, and that risk is not under their risk appetite labels. And if a certain risk is there, which cannot be, or which is not under their risk appetite side, that need to be addressed by some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you perhaps have an example of a funny moment? Because your job is a very sensitive and a very responsible role. But do you also crack some laughter with your colleagues if you see like a weird hacking attempt, or you see somebody does something outrageous?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, like, I cannot tell the incident, like, okay, what happened? Like, okay, I think it happened like 10 years ago or something like that. And someone reached out to me to if I can help them, you know, on a personal basis, basically. So, yeah, so I helped them to solve that case. But the case was like, it was a kind of a very interesting one. So they have an adversary and which is gaining into their access every day at morning 8 o'clock. Every day. And that adversary looked down into their code repository, that what kind of a code is making changes or something like that. And he just copied that code and go away. Every day from past 2 years, or basically something like that. So they're like, okay, how are we going to solve it? Because this is keep coming, though we have like blocked everything. But still, this one is like coming like on a daily basis. So what can be done? It's like, okay, why not you deploy something which is not of his interest or something like that, right? So they deploy some fake or something like that content over there. And the adversary was so smart, then he's like, I'm not here for this.
Okay.
He left a note. See, he seriously left a note over there. I'm not here for this. I know what I'm interested in.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, that's scary. But at the same time, hilarious. I'm like, okay, yeah. So he means that he knows like, okay, what he wants basically.
Okay. And how was this challenge overcome then in the end?
In the end, we were able to identify basically that how he was doing that one. Because what he has basically, he actually injected a backdoor. Or you can say remote access Trojan. So, and he's capturing the credentials of the user. So whenever he actually logs on or something like that, you reset the password or something, but he always get the new username or password.
Okay.
And back in the days, MFA was not much popular. Yeah. You know it, right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, like the era of 2010, like, okay, yeah, people goes with the username and password. So even you reset it, he got the new username and password and he always used that once.
Yeah. And do you sometimes sympathize with sort of the bad guys, because some of the attacks might be so brilliantly performed that maybe you sometimes have the feeling, they outsmarted us, or they found a loophole.
Of course, because these people, you know, sometimes if they come with a sophisticated or something, they spend like hours to find some sort of a small glitch or something that, right? And that's what security researchers also do. I think these bad guys can actually become a fantastic researcher if they want to be on a good side of it, because they have that mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what type of people would you fear most? Because we're already going a bit into threat intel, threat hunting. But is it the state actors or the...
No, I'm not much worried about the state actors, because the state actors are basically the rich lobbying party. And they have affiliates. And these affiliates are the real mastermind, basically. They knows what to get or something like that. So actors or nation state actors basically approach these affiliates and they actually work for them. And these affiliates could be a pen tester guy, could be a red teamer guy who's brilliantly in their research or something like that. So I'm like really, really scared about some genius researchers, because if they turned into the dark side of it, then it's going to be catastrophe.
Yeah, okay. So I think I understand that it's not the state actors, but the people that they will approach that actually now work on the defense side.
Exactly, yeah. Sometime a damn good developer can become an affiliate to a nation state, right? And then the nation state became more powerful. So it always about the skills and the people who are into this.
But it sounds like espionage, basically. You find...
It's a espionage. Yeah, it could be disruption. It could be hacktivism. It could be based upon ideology as well. Sometimes people are also brainwashed as well.
Yeah, it's almost like headhunting.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, if you see the groups, I'm like in the past, or what we see is also in the COVID time of it, there are like a lot of headhunting is being done by the criminal syndicates. And this is like, okay, yeah, we can work with you in a contract basis or maybe or this. They have their HR offices, they have their own people or something like that.
Yeah, you can contact support and then there's a whole, whole department.
Exactly. And you don't need to go to dark web. You have a one famous app called Telegram in your phone. Yeah, and you have handle name, just contact them over there. So, yeah. And that's where, and that's how I see that Telegram is becoming a new dark web or a new criminal syndicate contact application, basically, where a lot of, it's simply an abuse. It's not a feature or something. It's just an abusement.
But if we look at technology, have we not created all these loopholes? I feel it for the bad guys, the playground is becoming more and more attractive.
Yes, yeah, definitely. But if you see that the more the advanced technology goes it, then also the privacy concerns comes it. And these adversaries are abusing those privacy stuff like Telegram or Signal end-to-end encryption, right? So nobody can actually see your or hear your conversation. So of course, so for dark or for criminal syndicates, that's also became a, like a lucrative factor. Okay, let's use this.
Yeah. Yeah, we supply them with the tools almost. But that's not really true.
No. That's
they
why
find the tools.
Exactly. So that's the reason I always say that they abuse the things.
Yeah, that's the right word.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's a, and also like in many cases, when an adversary gained an access towards a corporate organizations, they don't bring their own tools because they use which we call as information security lolbens, living of the land binaries. So these are the binaries or the systems or the application which are legit part of it, but can be abused.
Yeah, check. Yeah, that's the scary part, I guess.
Yeah, that's the scary part because then for the detection teams, it became really difficult to identify whether it was a legit action or it was an illegit one.
No, it's very interesting. It's so fascinating. And I'm also curious what will happen in the next couple of years with all this new technology coming alive. But I wanted also to jump a bit deeper in your time with ABN AMRO Bank. Because after a few new roles, you eventually join ABN AMRO Bank.
Yeah.
And you really built the threat intelligence center basically from scratch.
Yeah.
But how does one start and how does one build such an intelligence center?
It was always a collaboration effort, a collaborative way, because intelligence is something like that where you can create it. But if your consumers are not going to consume in a right way, then it's not worth the time, basically. So it's very important that you get a support from your stakeholders. And I think I consider self as like very fortunate when I work with ABN AMRO that my stakeholders from different departments, they all are very, very proactive in this consumption. They always ask for the things and that makes it success, right? So leadership support is also equally important in that, which I always get it from my leaders in ABN AMRO. So, and that's what it makes a program like kind of a hit.
Do you see a lot of differences between different financial institutions or different areas across the world where you feel like, okay, this institution has better people, it's more ingrained in the culture, there are higher budgets for security? Does it really depend per organization or per region?
It's not per region. I think it is per organization and it's also leadership. I think leadership play a key role in it, and especially the senior management leadership from the CISO side of it, which plays a key role in it. If they do understand it and if they have a good strategy, everything goes well smooth. If they don't have that one, then of course things might fall off into different directions or something like that. But whenever they see it from the risk appetite level, right? So every financial institute could have a different risk appetite to different things, and that's how they strategize.
And have you felt that some places where you've been, they spend too little on security? That's always difficult to measure.
Yeah, it's very difficult to measure, basically. And it's also depend like, okay, what is your exposure factor? You know, some organization might like spend billions where they could have like spent only millions and that it could have done the job. But It's up to them, like, okay, how they actually measuring their risk. Business always measures their risks based upon their assets or based upon the risk they can actually hold off.
Yeah, but for a security professional working in a CISO team or department, the higher the budget, the more fun it could be, right? It's always nice to have a higher budget.
Yeah, it's always can be nice, but at the same time, you have to practical as well, right? And that's where the defender life and the responsibility comes into the factor. You need to look for the fit for purpose solution, you know? You know, my current manager, he always make a quote, which I really liked it. Like, if I need to go from here to airport, I can rent a car or I can actually buy a car as well. But renting a car will be an easy solution. Why should I buy a car?
Yeah. So with every action you want to do the most practical and
exactly.
Ideally the cheapest option.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like it need to be fit for the purpose, right? And if you have a fit for purpose solutions, they are sustainable as well.
Yeah. And to come back a bit to the Abrinambo phase, mm-hmm. Perhaps a stupid question, but can you explain sort of in easy words, what would you consider threat intelligence and threat hunting and why is it so important nowadays?
It's always, I think it's an important part. And if I have to summarize in a smaller sentence or something like that, is basically predictive analytics. What can happen next? What are your adversaries? And what are their capabilities? And are you ready for their arsenals when they're actually knocking on your door?
But is it predictive analytics? Is it all run by data? Or is the threat hunting also to crawl in the skin of a bad guy?
So threat intelligence and threat hunting are like two different elements. Threat intelligence is basically which comes from the outside angle to see it like, okay, what are your adversaries? So like who and why? Like, okay, why they wanted to attack and how, right? And then threat hunting is basically the hypothesis driven, where you see that, did they already attack your environment? Yes and no. Because that answer, Intel cannot give you, hunting can give you. So that's why you need to combine them into one function so that at least you get the best out of it.
And where do you start?
I always started from the Intel side of it. Because Intel side of it means that you need to have an hypothesis, right? Like, so what are you searching for? Let's say that any APT, let's say APT 10, right? It make a big name in the earlier days when with the supply chain compromises or something like that. So, yeah. So what are their TTPs basically? And are you considering those TTPs in your hunting side of it? And then you derive your hypothesis based upon those TTPs and then you search for it. And during that search, if you are like, okay, or you can say like, it's your best day or something like that, maybe you will find a compromise. I wish not. But yeah, if you find it, then yes, you know that, okay, it worked. But if not, then at least you know that, okay, if they will use those TTPs, do you have the detection capability in place? If not, then build it.
Yep.
So that's why I call it like, it's a kind of a predictive, means that if you, first of all, it gives you two answers. Does the adversary targeted you at this moment? Yes and no. And the answer, if the answer is no, then is well good. And then the second part is, are you ready for their attack? And this will also give you like, okay, yeah, by simulation or something like that, whether your blue team were able to detect it or not. If not, then you are not ready and there is a chance.
It seems a little bit what we discussed before, that when you go in threat hunting, you have to have the hacker mindset.
Exactly, yeah.
But then you come awfully close to what we discussed before, that the good guys are already stepping into the skin of the bad guys.
Yes.
So they know exactly what to do to break through.
Exactly. And that's where I think intelligence became one of the important part of it, because the intelligence, when I say intelligence, the real intelligence comes from it when you actually monitor these e-crime syndicates, their new malware campaigns or something like that, then you know it like, okay, what they are building up. And when they are building it up, if you get the source codes or something like that, then you know that how it's going to work.
And you mentioned these crime organizations.
Yeah.
Who are they then? Is it sort of the mafia or the drugs cartels?
It's an e-crime syndicate. Sometimes it could be run by a small, like 14-year-old kid as well.
They build an empire.
Yeah, they can build an empire.
Yeah, have you seen this read about it?
Yes, I dealt a case. I cannot name the case and for which organization. Yeah, I dealt a case where the mastermind was a 15-year-old kid.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And how did he build this organization and how many people were part
online,
of it?
Online. Everything accessible online. It's just a means of a skill set and finding a victim and the exposure. You know, and that's why I always recommend the organization look at what you are offering towards outside, because that's an opportunity. Any rogue services or any sort of an open entry towards your door or something like that, it creates an opportunity. And even if the hacker doesn't have any intention or motivation, but if he sees the opportunity that he can compromise you, he will simply utilize it.
But for financial institutions, you just have a red dot on your head.
Yeah.
Like everybody knows that's where you want to be.
Yep.
So then it's impossible not to have people that gonna look for little cracks in your door.
Of course. They were always looking for it. And that's why for financial institute, it's very important basically to look from the external angle as well. Like, okay, what has been exposed? You know, and what kind of an opportunity or how your organization looks like from outside.
Yeah.
You know, when I started my career back in the days of era of 2003 and 2005 and 2008, external attack surface was not even a concept. We were just like protecting internal assets, firewalls or something like that. But now the game changes. There is like a lot of a shift. And even the free tools like Shodan and all, you just make a query of the target organization, you will see. So there are like a lot of tools out there freely available, which is used by both good siders and the bad sides guys as well. And it's basically depend upon the sites. Like, okay, if the good side is taking those things into account and increasing their resilience, then it's making more difficult for the red side of it.
But there's a true battle going on.
It's always. It's just like that now defenders started understanding like there is a huge responsibility on their shoulders. It's not a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, we just discussed it. We're recording just after Easter. It's been a long weekend.
Yeah.
People took some days off. But yeah, the defenders, they were still working.
Exactly, yeah. So back in the days when like security operations center concept started and it's started by like 24/7, there is a reason for it, because if the criminals are not sleeping, then defenders also don't need to sleep then, right?
Yeah, but it's challenging with SOCs. But it was nice what you said with Swift, that it's sort of a follow the sun principle.
Yeah.
That you have three locations spread across the world.
Exactly, yeah.
But what I find interesting, what you mentioned, and I think that's also your philosophy to have a more predictive way of looking at cybersecurity. I think your current role, because after ABN AMRO in the beginning of this year, you switched to the Volvo Group.
Yeah.
And you became sort of the head of active cyber defense. And that's a word I really find interesting and I like a lot, because it's active cyber defense. And can you explain what that means?
Well, active cyber defense is basically is before the boom kind of stuff, like more on the prevention, protection, and identification side of it. So that's also include like, okay, how we prevent our systems, how we look on the intelligence side of it, how we make sure that we have a right level of posture, attack surface reductions, and that's why it's called the active cyber defense.
But your previous experience comes in very handy, I believe.
Yes, yeah. So that experience really helps me over here as well to see it from that mindset of it. And especially my intelligence side of it, because when I see from the criminal side of it, then of course, I always think about the intent, opportunity, and motivation angle. So that's a famous triad we have it, you know. And if you are exposing or if you are giving the opportunity, then of course, then you are offering yourself to the bad guys.
Yeah.
So that's where you need to reduce these opportunities.
And for Volvo Group, it's one of the biggest automotive companies, but of course, it's also a huge manufacturing and production company.
Yeah.
It's perhaps more in critical infrastructure, OT environments. What are some of the risks that you now have to take in consideration that you did not have with the bank, for instance?
Well, with the bank, especially it's a financial system which is run by the algorithms and all. But if you see, especially in the manufacturing side of it, then you are dealing with machines and but also with people as well. So the way I differentiate between the IT security and the OT security, the famous triad, which we call as CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So confidentiality goes first, then integrity, then availability in the IT world. OT world is different. It's opposite. It's the availability is the first.
It always has to run.
It's always on the run. So then, and also if you see the OT security machines and whatnot, then you have to think, like, you need to find a fit for purpose solution. I cannot have the heavy, bulky kind of a system to put it in an OT environment where they even cannot work. So that's where you need to look for those solution which can actually gives a balance between the availability and between the security side of it. And also, it's a quite complex because not every technology in OT can be protected by that means. And so you need to find it like, it's a kind of a out of the box thinking kind of stuff. So you need to always think like, okay, what is required? Sometime you can have the product which is available in the market, but sometime you have to build it based upon the situation which demands. You know, what I always say is that if a small script can solve the purpose, then why you need to buy a big program?
Yep. Yeah, but that's the same example you gave before with going to the airport.
Yeah,
it needs to fit the purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah, and what keeps you now up at night? What are some of the things that really concern you in this new environment?
Well, I think with the Volvo journey, it's going smooth, but I'm also a part-time researcher as well, so that's actually keeps me awake at night. In what way I can actually contribute back to my society, you know, like finding these hackers, working with the other peoples to make sure that they cannot abuse the other infrastructures or they cannot target hospitals or something like that. You know, so this is basically my concern also. So whenever I see these kind of things that, okay, where are they going to target, where it's question related to lives or something, then I became scared and that keeps me awake at the night.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you sort of what's the legacy that you want to leave within the cybersecurity domain, but perhaps this is already something you're really passionate about.
Collaboration and sharing of your knowledge. That is very, very important in this because no one is expert. Everybody is a learner. We all are learning. The way the technology is changing, I think October 2022 last year, nobody is aware about ChatGPT, right? But then the ChatGPT changed the whole game, right? So, and in the future, it will. A lot of new AI things will come of it. So you have to be a learner and you can learn only when you actually share the things, you know, with people and collaborate with people. That's how it is.
And is ChatGPT, is it really a game changer for the blue side?
It's a game changer for both, basically. Not only for blue, but for the red side of it as well. You can create your own malwares basically using ChatGPT's functions.
Yeah, that's scary.
That's also a scary part of it. So that's why, I mean, like, it's a technology and it's a really impressive technology. But if it is falls into the bad hands, then yeah.
Yeah, but we already said that the bad guys will abuse these tools that come available. Have you already seen situations where malware perhaps has been written by AI?
Yes, I've already seen the scenarios actually.
Yeah.
I've already seen the scenarios. Yeah, and in the researcher community, there are a few malwares have been shared as well, which has purely been written by ChatGPT's functions.
Yeah.
And when you see their codes, it's like, okay, yeah, I wish I know this language. So
Oh, yeah. That's so, something to worry about. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, it's something like that. Now a normal script kiddie who doesn't have a big understanding of any software programming or something like that, he can just use this function or feature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even to tweak his own programs or something like that. But I'm sure that security community will work on this and they will figure it out, like how we can actually overcome of this situation in the upcoming time.
Now, it's very fascinating that you've been in the industry since 2008 and worked in different field, now completely new industry. But I do see you as sort of a front runner for threat intelligence and all the research you've done, threat hunting exercises and building this center within ABN AMRO from scratch. So that means you always seem to follow the latest trends. And that's, I think, the first guest that's really always on the front line.
It's a necessity, basically.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Because if we will not follow the trends or development, then we will not able to protect our own organizations.
Yeah. And as a hiring manager, you mentioned, what is it that you look for? Is it the same curiosity that you have?
Yeah, curious nature. That is most of the important things. And then your attitude toward learning.
That's more important than the skills or the certifications
yes,
that you have.
Yeah, exactly. Certifications, yeah, sometimes it's good. But I think it's not like that. I don't take people who don't have any certification or something like that. Because it's a learning, basically. Certificate only gives you stamps, basically, out of that one. But in real life, in real hands-on, what you learn is way more than that.
And how do you see sort of the talent gap? Because there are millions of unfilled vacancies across the world, and this number is increasing. Is this something that you've seen within previous organizations, that the main issue could be we just don't have the people to fight on our side?
Yeah, I think cybersecurity was not used to be a subject which has been taught in universities, you know, back in the days. And that's where the legacy comes in. But now in the days, I see a lot of universities are adding these as a subjects on their side of it. So right now, yes, there is a resource constraint at this moment, but I'm really optimistic for the future. Maybe after 2030 or something like that, we will not have this shortage. But for now, yes, it is a big shortage.
But you're one of the first guests to say that the shortage will hopefully decrease. So that's a positive note. I'm happy to hear it.
Yeah, exactly. Because when I actually teach in the universities or something like that, I see that, that's a lot of students are basically fascinating about this and they are opting for these subjects. I was in US last month, basically, and I also gave a guest lecture in one of the universities over there. And over, I met with a lot of students and everybody was saying like, yeah, now we are actually moving into the cyber areas because we think our future lies there. So, and it's also, I think, from the organization or the community side of it, we need to give the freshers more chances. Sometimes what I feel that cybersecurity industry doesn't give like fair chances to the freshers because they think that, okay, those guys doesn't have that knowledge or something. But Rome was not built in a day, right? So that concept goes over here. We need to train people more.
But it aligns very much with what you say, hire for attitude, not for skills. So that aligns with your philosophy. And then you can also bring in people with different backgrounds or are young professionals.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
But it's really cool that you also share your experience, not only with the companies you serve, but also at the university and the research you do. So that's really impressive.
Yeah.
And what are some of the goals you still have? You want to stay of service or is there something else you would like to solve?
Yeah, something like that. I really want to pass on this as a legacy for the upcoming generations, where they also think with this mindset that it's not only a job or something, you know, it's about like protecting the human lives in the last. Everything is connected these days, any technology or any something like that. If a disruption happened on one side of it, it might lead to something. So if you can actually stop that disruption, you are saving something.
Yeah, I love it. It's more than a job.
It's more than a job. Yeah. So I always believe in a word, one word, which I call STEP, S-T-E-P. And S for security takes everyone participation.
Love it. Yeah. Let's make that one go viral.
Yeah.
And if there are any young professionals listening to this conversation, would you have any advice for them?
Stick to the basics and follow the process.
And if there's one signal message, and this is the last question we always ask, but if there's one signal message that you can send to all the CISOs across the world, what would that signal message then say?
So the signal message will be is the bad guys have enough chances to penetrate into organization, but defenders, they have to successful always in stopping them. So always take care of your defenders, give them a good room, give them a good growth basically. And whenever you see that, okay, they are tired, give them a hug.
Yeah, that's lovely. Do you feel that the good guys get enough appreciation? Because what you say, you've done some very important work these last 20 years, but it's also done behind computers and the damage that you've prevented, nobody knows basically because you cannot share it in the open.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I think that's a part of the job, right? You don't, whatever you do it, if you do with the intention that you need to get a fame or something, that then it's not a job, basically. Then you are just running behind fame.
Yeah, and on the other hand, you do it in the dark, so you don't get the fame for it. Sometimes you don't even get the proper financial compensation for it. And on the other side, you have to stay sane and not take a nice big budget from the bad guy. So no,
yeah, but that's where the leadership comes in, you know. And my leadership was always wherever I worked, they always appreciate these kind of things. So I've been rewarded like from both the angles. So I never felt disappointed actually in this.
But it's also about appreciation, and I think
that's more important. You know, it's basically most important when you step into a room or something like that with your colleagues. You need to make sure that you make them aware that how awesome they are, not like how awesome you are.
Yeah, that's some wisdom right there.
Yeah, so it's very important because people then feel engaged as well. And trust me, like, okay, whenever I do this, I do it from bottom of my heart because I know that my guys or my colleagues, they spend like hours to make things happen, you know. Sometime like whenever there is an incident or something, they are working like till late nights basically. They have a family, they have a life, they can stop at 5, but they are not stopping it because they do care.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating industry. Yeah. But I think we should appreciate the good guys more and more. That's my takeaway from this conversation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Because the sense of responsibility these guys have it, in spite of having like bulky processes, a lot of law and regulation, something like that, but still they are giving their 100%.
Yeah.
More than 100%, I would say.
And you've been doing this for the last 20 years, so also my appreciation towards
Thank you.
And also for joining us on this podcast and sharing all your knowledge. I think that's very important as well. So much gratitude and
thank you very much. It's my pleasure to
really
share
enjoyed
this information.
It. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Lalit.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lawrence. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Cybersecurity Talks. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to review and subscribe. For all further information on our live events and new podcast releases, go to csrecruitment.nl. Thank you and stay safe.